Hey, this is James Ayler with the Fringe Voices Show. The Fringe Voices Show is about bringing interesting people with interesting ideas together to converse, to share these ideas with the rest of the world. I hope you enjoy today's episode with Vinay Gupta. And again, if you like this podcast, you like this episode, please rate and review it on wherever you're listening to it, Apple Podcasts or whatever. And thank you so much and enjoy the show. Before we jump into this episode, this is James from Fringe Voices. I just wanted to let you know about Anchor. Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. It's free, and they have plenty of tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. In addition, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more places. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor, ANCHOR.FM to get started. Thank you. Hey, this is James Ayler, host of the Fringe Voices Show. Today, I want to thank Vinay Gupta for taking time out of his busy schedule to speak with me about pandemics and specifically the coronavirus. Vinay Gupta is a Renaissance man and futurist interested in the technological transformation of society and commerce. Vinay has a strong track record of thought leadership in environmental and infrastructure risk, failing states, energy policy, and disaster management. He was also responsible for launching the cryptocurrency Ethereum and is currently the founder and CEO of Materium, a technology startup for creating digital identities for the world of physical goods. This is a long introduction, though, but for an impressive man, thank you so much, Vinay, for joining us. How are you doing today?
I am a little fried. This is a very intense time for me. We've just launched a product. Obviously, I'm kind of sorting out my affairs to get kind of ready for dealing with the pandemic. We're doing a bunch of resilience work to make sure that, you know, if members of the company get ill, we can kind of have people cover their areas for a while. It's an intense time.
It sounds like it. And, you know, especially what's going on in Italy right now, the whole country's on a lockdown. And what made me want to reach out to you, though, is your tweet from a couple days ago when you said, F it, I guess we're doing the flu. Can you explain this tweet and how you're treating the coronavirus going forward?
So I used to work on large scale disaster stuff. I was a theoretician working mainly in think tanks. And, you know, what I was interested in was just, you know, how do you handle, like, extreme worst case stuff, right? I was Mr. Extreme Worst Case Stuff. And I used to carry a business card that says, I don't get out of bed for less than 1% mortality. So my general rule was, because, you know, there was some model who famously said, you know, I don't get out of bed for less than 10 grand, darling. So, you know, it was kind of a reference to that. I don't get out of bed for less than 1% mortality. So I like it. When it looked like Corona's was probably had a CFR around 1% of people that caught it died. You figure a third to half of the population will catch it, worst case. You know, it was kind of like, you know, this is going to be really bad, but this is not really my problem. Because it was just outside of my area of direct real competence, right?
Sure.
But then as the news got worse and worse and worse, I'm like, okay, hang on. You know, the CFR is not 1% of people get it died. The CFR is like 3-5% maybe, and we've got this whole problem with enormous numbers of people that need respirators, which is going to overwhelm. And I sort of started to put together the numbers like, oh, actually, you know, this may not be the big one, but it's big enough that I actually have to pay attention, and I'm kind of, you know, morally or socially obligated to do at least something about this.
Yeah, and which I really agree with, because as you may have seen, Elon Musk recently tweeted the coronavirus panic is dumb. I find some I don't know what the right word is for it, but I don't think it's right. And do you think panic is warranted, and if so, why? And also, as a follow-up question, be what would do you think would be an appropriate response from someone with that stature that could use their money for social good?
Elon Musk is already completely tapped out on social good, right?
Sure.
You know, I mean, he's doing superhuman amounts across a vast range of areas. He's really, really, really completely deployed. So, you know, expecting him to do any more than that is unrealistic. Frankly, expecting him to even have a realistic model of what's happening, the guy is not a microbiologist. You know, he's not an epidemiologist. He's not a flu statistician. We really shouldn't care what Elon Musk says about things outside of his area of expertise any more than we care about football players discussing pop music.
That's a good point. I'll take that.
Right. You know, it's kind of not his bag. And, you know, okay, he said something stupid about it, but he said something stupid about an area that he's got no, like, demonstrated expertise in, and nobody's paying him to have an opinion on this. So I think Elon Musk got this one wrong, but, you know, Elon Musk is allowed to make mistakes.
That's also a good point. Regardless of what Elon Musk is saying, I know that especially in the United States right now, and the current administration is talking about this isn't time to panic, although they have, the CDC has raised the red flag for citizens over the age of 60. Do you think that people should be panicked, or how do you think an appropriate response would be considering what's going on right now?
So we keep using this word panic, right? Like, disciplined, effective response is what we want. And panic is, generally speaking, not really, like, you know, if you actually look at what constitutes rational action as recommended by governments, most of the things that they're telling people to do are behaviors which are generally thought of as being panic behaviors, right? The CDC has given out guidance saying that people who are over 60 should get a bunch of groceries, go home, and stay the hell away from people until this blows over. So if that's from the CDC, is that panic? Is that the CDC panicking? Or is that the CDC doing their job and giving out sound epidemiological advice, which is stay the heck away from people if you're older?
Exactly.
It's not really panic if the CDC tells you to do it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with that. One other thing I wanted to talk about is that currently New York State last Monday had 2 cases of positive coronavirus patients, and now we're up to 142 as of this past Monday, yesterday. I'm worried myself that New York State is not handling or taking it seriously enough right now, considering what's going on. Also, with your experience, what do you think would be an appropriate response right now?
So here we get into this problem with a kind of, you know, how do we know what's real? How do we know what's happening? How do we know what to do? The bottom line right now is that we're all pretty information scarce about what is going on, right? Like, you know, we've seen a few tweets going around recently purporting to be reports from Italian doctors about what's happening in hospitals in Italy. And those reports are super grim. And I've passed that material on because it sounds fairly credible from the other things that I've learned in other places, and it kind of forms an operational picture. But I've got no way of verifying that those stories are true. I'm not 100% sure that that's the whole picture. You know, how do I really know, right? So
that's correct.
We're guessing, right? We have to make intelligent guesses based on the information in front of us. And the bottom line here is that if you guess wrong in the direction of taking more action, you wind up with a bunch of groceries and you close your office for 2 weeks or a month and everybody works from home. It's a little bit of inconvenience and a little bit of capital outlay. If you guess wrong in the other direction and you take less action than you should have, the possibility is that you get infected, you wind up really ill, or you get infected, you accidentally infect a bunch of other people, and then one of them dies.
Yeah.
So this is a situation where it's relatively harmless to take this really seriously and react very strongly, and it's potentially extremely harmful to ignore it and think it'll all blow over. So I kind of feel like this is something where it's relatively safe to take strong action, and it's relatively dangerous to fail to act when you could have acted or should have acted. So I think that generally speaking, we ought to be taking this pretty damn seriously. And if it turns out that for some reason it's a dry run, like oncoming summer stops the disease in its tracks, one possibility, or we wind up with one of these rapid vaccine programs producing something that works, or they discover that one of the standard antivirals is completely effective, you just have to use it in a particular way. You know, there are a whole bunch of things which could happen that will make this into a false alarm, but I would much rather that people reacted appropriately, treated it like a fire drill, left the building in an orderly way, than sat there saying, hey, this is just a fire drill, we're going to ignore the alarm, And then when you start smelling smoke, you know, like, we've already lost the stairwells.
Exactly. And I'm in agreement with you, and I'm by no means any kind of expert on the coronavirus or pandemics especially, but I do feel that there hasn't been that type of response, especially in the United States. I can't speak for the UK right now, but I think...
Well, I mean, the CDC guidance is super strong. You know, the CDC has really nailed its cover so fast by telling, you know, older people to stay at home. Because, you know, once the CDC says, look, you know, it's really important that you go home, you stay home, this is really bad for you, get the heck out of town. When was the last time the CDC told any segment of the American population, go home, stay home, it's really important you don't get this disease? You know, it's not like go and get your seasonal flu shot, it's a really good idea. It's the CDC is telling you that if you don't go home and stay home and you're older, you're endangering yourself and you're endangering other people, and you please comply.
Yeah, you that's know, a good point.
What else does the CDC have to do, right?
That's you true. Know,
guys, yeah. This is a real problem. So I think the American apparatus has taken maybe a little bit of time to ramp up, but I think the American apparatus has ramped up. You do see a certain amount of chatter from the White House, like, ah, oh, this whole thing is kind of overblown. But again, it's the Elon Musk thing, right? I am unaware of Donald Trump having any substantial expertise in infectious diseases. I'm far more inclined to listen to the CDC than I am to listen to the president on this issue.
And yeah, I like your balanced approach to this too. I think that that's bringing some sort of... I would hesitate the word saneness, but it's bringing some sort of modicum to the conversation too. I kind of want to switch gears just a little bit. Assuming that this is a like semi worst case scenario where you know, the government is possibly not going to respond correctly to a mass like epidemic of this coronavirus, what are some examples of decentralized or distributed and autonomous actions that citizens can take and for this type of pandemic?
So this entire situation is bound by a very, very simple logic, right? I mean, it's just, there's a lot of chatter, there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of storytelling, but it's all bound by a simple logic, which is the coronavirus is an infectious agent, right? It's a bug. And if you don't get the bug, you don't get sick. And the only way that you get the bug is by coming into direct contact with either a person or a surface which is infected. Right? That's our starting rules of the game are you get the bug by somebody sneezing on you or by touching something that somebody sneezed on, pretty much. Correct. I'm oversimplifying very slightly, but it's not something where somebody, you know, sneezes in a football stadium and 25 million people get sick, right? It's within the bounds of infectiousness where it is very infectious, but it's infectious in a way which is close partial contact, sneezes, and it sticks on surfaces really effectively. So at this point, it comes down to don't have somebody sneeze on you and don't touch something that a sick person touched. And if everybody plays by those rules, right, don't get close to sick people and don't touch something that sick people have touched, really pretty quickly the disease is not your problem anymore because it's nowhere near you. You're not infected. Life is good. What makes this complicated is that people could be sick and have no symptoms, which means they're wandering around the world doing ordinary people's stuff, and they're also contaminating everything that they touch and everybody that they meet. And this is the situation that we have right now. We can't effectively discriminate between the people that are ill and the people who aren't ill, which means that you could be infected by people that have no symptoms. So what this means is that we start having to say, okay, margin of caution is we have to treat everybody as if they're infected until proven otherwise. And that's where things become complicated, because now what we have is this kind of what they call about social distancing, where we have to start assuming that the people around us are potentially infected, and then we have to start not letting them seize on us and not touching anything that they've touched in a really broad and comprehensive way.
Yeah, and I know you living in London and me in New York City, this is kind of a complicated issue, right?
It's kind of a complicated issue. And you can see, you know, what happens is you start from very simple, basic principles of like, this is an infectious disease and this is how you don't get infected by infectious diseases. And pretty soon it builds out into, you know, quarantine, masks, gloves, you know, constant hand washing, never seeing your friends, staying indoors, having food delivered, then squirting the delivery boxes with bleach before you open them, right? Because from those first principles, when you get active about, okay, so I never want to come into contact with this virus, how do I avoid that? It turns out that there is a whole bunch of ramifications which build up around that.
Correct. And one thing that I know people have been pushing back on, especially in New York City, is the mayor doesn't want to shut down schools only as a last resort. And he has many valid reasons, such as the custody and nutritional functions that schools provide. But what do you think of this response, and what are some ways that the learning and nutrition functions could still be provided with school closures?
Let me ask a dumb question. Why are they so against the idea of closing the schools?
Well, so they said that there's 100,000, I might be misquoting this, but there's 100,000 homeless students, and they provide like shelter for them. They also provide meals for low-income for low-income families, it also provides a way for them to take care of the children.
Got it. So it's feeding and warehousing functions that they're really interested in. I mean, you know, bottom line, sure, but, you know, how long is it before somebody turns up at one of these places sick, and then suddenly everybody in the school system is sick?
Exactly.
Right? You know, the Japanese closed all of their schools, what, a month ago?
Yeah, and they've had very little reported fatalities, correct?
The Japanese are really good at not sneezing on each other. Right? You know that thing where when Asian people get sick, they all tend to wear surgical masks?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just don't walk around, you know, without, if you have any kind of a sniffle, you just don't walk around without a surgical mask as a way of confining the sniffles. Well, if that's your baseline for the common cold, you've already got a strong model of infectious disease management in the culture, which can then be rapidly built on when you get something much more serious like coronavirus.
Makes a lot of sense, yeah, which I know around here we don't necessarily have that going on. We do have a lot of close social contact and people sneezing, although it has been getting, people are becoming more aware and mindful of it.
Yeah, people are becoming more aware is a good start. And I mean, also there's a particularly American thing, which is like, you know, you've got the flu, you know, chug half a bottle of NyQuil, you go to work and you do like a 12-hour day, and everybody acts like you're a hero.
Exactly.
Right. And this is not really the time for just sort of muscling through.
Correct. I agree totally. And I think, you know, that could touch off into some other aspects of what's going on now, especially politically. But speaking of someone actually, I can't remember the name of it, but I think there's a congressperson that is interested in a bill to implement a universal basic income in response to this potential, I guess you could say, lockdown of citizens being, you know, out of work because of this pandemic. What do you think about a universal basic income at this time? And do you think it is a good response?
So I think organizing it in the amount of time that we have available is probably unrealistic. I just don't even know. I mean, you know, think of the number of Americans that don't have bank accounts that you'd have to try to figure out a way of paying the universal basic income to.
Yeah, I get it.
So, I see absolutely the practicality, right? If you're going to expect people to stay home from work when they're ill, and a third of the population are ill, and you want them to stay home long enough so that they don't infect the other two thirds if they go to work when they're still ill, then it makes perfect sense that you would have universal basic income as a way of having people go home and stay home. And it may be that there are social service programs that could be kind of expanded or leveraged to provide that basic income kind of bureaucracy, the management of the funds. But, you know, I just, in the amount of time available, I find it hard to believe they're going to be able to get that organized in time for it to have an operational impact.
That's a good point. Yeah, it makes me feel kind of stupid because I didn't even think about that practicality aspect of it. It could be more.
On the other hand, I mean, this thing is going to run for months, right? So yeah. You know, maybe there are rapid ways of doing this, right? You take voter rolls or something. You know, there are big available initial data sets. Maybe you could build up very rapidly on top of that. Maybe you deploy the whole thing as some kind of app and the whole thing works like, you know, phone credit. There might be ways of doing it. You know, if you walked into Google and said, right, you know, you, Microsoft, Apple, and Facebook, you're going to figure out how we distribute universal basic income and you're going to do it in, you know, 6 weeks, they could probably figure it out. Right?
That's true.
You know, you put enough money on the table and you go to the tech giants and say, make this work, they could probably find some way of doing it. But, you know, getting that done realistically, yeah, I find it hard to believe federal government could be fast enough to deliver that in the available timescale.
Yeah, I agree. Just a couple more things I wanted to talk about if you still have enough time.
Yeah, sure.
Another cause of concern is your colleague Luis Gonzalez was talking about in a, I believe he had a document about pandemics that was with the European Union CDC, where he describes yes. Healthcare system insufficiency. I mean, I know what that means, and you do as well, but could you briefly describe this and why this may be a concern with this coronavirus?
Sure. So, I mean, Lucas and I worked very hard on pandemic flu way back in the day. If you go to resiliencemaps.org, that's resiliencemaps.org, you can see a number of documents there, one of which is a report that Lucas wrote on the pandemic flu and how you manage it in island economies. So Lucas was the head of pandemic flu monitoring for the Canary Islands. And in the Canaries, they've got, you know, 2 million people living in a place that has very little fresh water, for example. So there's a whole bunch of infrastructure to maintain to make sure that you continue to have a fresh water supply on the island to go to people's needs. So with all of this stuff, the bottom line is how many people get the disease, how quickly. If everybody gets it very, very, very quickly because it's very contagious, then what happens is that those cases swamp the hospitals because everybody's sick at the same time, and the hospitals just overload, and then they can no longer deliver services. And that's a very, very bad and very realistic scenario. It's what we're seeing in Italy. And once the hospitals are saturated, anybody after that that gets ill is very, very hard to help, because the hospitals are the only people with the tools and the expertise to help. Even if what needs to be done is very complicated, you need to start with hospital level know-how to do it. So that problem of we've just swamped our hospitals and people are still getting sick and we've got nowhere to help them is the worst aspect of the coronavirus epidemic that we've seen so far. And that's what's happening in Italy right now, is allegedly in much of Italy, the hospitals are now completely full. The medical personnel are completely tapped out and they still have to try and do the best they can. But as a result, mortality rates are going through the roof.
Yeah. And I know that one of the concerns is like you said, is in the United States, and I'm sure the UK as well, because in the United States, we don't even have that many hospital beds that could carry, like that much capacity of diseased people. So it is a very real possibility. I agree.
It's a real concern. I mean, it didn't happen in Japan because Japan has an enormous number of hospital beds relative to their population. But the American system has gotten driven very lean by the ways that we pay for healthcare. And as a result, when something malfunctions, there's not much resilience to catch the problems and to stop the effects becoming worse.
Switching gears just a tiny bit, I know that you have talked, and also Lewis has talked about the simple critical infrastructure maps.
Yes.
I wanted to just briefly explain that for people that may not be familiar, and maybe provide one example of applying this to this current situation.
So the simple critical infrastructure map system is a checklist-based system which is intended to take groups of early responders and allow them to work through the situation that they're in a way that allows them to get like good management of their available needs and resources. So a typical model would be, you know, think of a small town where you've got the mayor, the chief of the police, and the head of the hospital getting together to try and figure out how they're going to approach the coronavirus problem. You can use this for individual household level stuff, and it will work effectively for household level planning, but it's really aimed at sort of small municipal planning where people are being pushed outside of their areas of expertise, and there's very little support from the federal government or even the state government, because the really severe cases are where they're going to focus all of their attention, and the people that are kind of muddling through are going to get neglected because those resources will be put into the areas which are worst hit. So, for example, the last news I heard was that Seattle had a really big cluster and the conditions had gotten pretty rough in Seattle. And, you know, obviously the federal government and the state government would be focusing their attention there rather than on some small town, you know, on the other side of Washington State, where things are basically okay because they haven't really had any cases yet and they kind of got on top of things and they're waiting for the problem to begin. So that approach of, you know, don't count on federal resources, don't count on state resources because they will ruthlessly prioritize to save the maximum number of lives, and that doesn't necessarily mean helping you first, means that to a very substantial degree, when you're facing this problem, you're on your own. And as Lucas used to say, you know, the trick of all of these techniques is going from you're on your own to we're on our own, right? Mm-hmm. You should go from, yo-yo to wo-wo, right? How do we work together? And the we is quite important because, you know, the supply chains are complicated things, right? You know, if you're in a position where you're sort of quarantining at home and staying away from people, if you don't need anything that you don't have, that's fine. But when you, you know, run out of diapers or discover that somebody has a bacterial infection on, and, you know, needs treatment separately from the viral infection, or, you know, somebody, you know, your dog breaks its leg, you know, you're going to need help. And the existing mechanisms that we use for organizing that help come under an enormous amount of strain in these kind of times. People don't necessarily have money to pay for services. You may not have all the normal preconditions and supply chains that you'd have, for example, for veterinary supplies, medical supplies, you know, even, you know, basic stuff like you break your glasses and you need to find a pair that are good enough for you to see out of. You need to be able to talk to people in a different way because you can't just go down to the opticians and get another pair made because those guys are closed. So you have to think of this in terms of you need to organize enough interconnection inside of the community that people can help each other, but not so much that they then proceed to infect each other. It's quite a fine line, right? You want enough of a network in place for, you know, mutual support, mutual aid, but you don't want such, you know, you don't want people to go back into a position where they're infecting each other. So the question then is, how do you organize this kind of cooperativism? And what the SCIM system does is it provides you with an objective baseline for working, right? It gives you a starting point. And this is why it's so important it's checklist-based. So the way you use this thing is you have a problem, you have a bunch of people sitting on a Skype call or sitting around a table, their job is to solve the problem. The problem is, how do we keep everybody under our care alive? So you start at the beginning, you go around the checklist. The checklist is individual needs, right? Are the individuals under our care having problems? Okay, first, is anybody too cold? Do we have any death or risk of death from cold? Yes, no. If you've got problems that are being caused by cold, those are your number one priorities. You've got to sort that out first, or people will literally freeze to death on your watch. Cold first. Second question, heat. Is anybody dying of heat? Do we have people that are getting exposed to heat? You know, have we lost air conditioning in medical buildings? What's our heat problem? So, too hot, right? Too cold, hunger, thirst, illness, injury. Conventionally, you'd put thirst as more urgent than hunger, but we put hunger first because we wanted thirst and illness to be next to each other, because in most situations where you have a crisis like an earthquake, the first thing that you're going to hit is people are drinking water to deal with their thirst, and then the second thing is the water will be contaminated because of things like burst sewers, and now you've got an epidemic on your hands. So it's very important. That makes sense. Right? This is really common post-earthquake. You just wind up with a whole just parcel of problems because all the water pipes are broken. There's water pouring out holes in the ground from broken water pipes, and the water is also contaminated. New problem. So too hot, too cold, hunger, thirst, illness, injury. So in this instance, illness is our primary concern, and it comes down to how are we going to manage the illness situation. And the illness situation, you know, the skin model works across levels of political organization. So you go from individuals, households, neighborhoods, municipalities, regions, nation states, and then the global level. So when we start talking about illness, the individual level of illness is don't get sick, right? Make an individual plan for staying away from the virus. Second part level of illness is the household level, right? Make a plan for your household to not get sick. Now we start thinking about making sure that we as a team, as all the people that are sharing the same roof and are sharing essentially the same infection risk, are all operating effectively to protect the other people in our household, right? Then we say, okay, what about the neighborhood level? This is where you start having to talk to your neighbors and say, right, so, you know, can we just make an arrangement where we, you know, call each other once a day just to make sure that nobody in that house is sick? And if somebody is sick, we figure out how to get them supplies without causing the infection to spread, right? Layer by layer by layer by layer, it involves making new ways of dealing with people, because the old situation was you just walked into stores and bought things for cash. The new situation is a lot of the stores will be closed, a lot of the people running the stores will be ill, a lot of the supply chains that run the things to the stores will be down. And, you know, the thing about this is that what gets you in these situations is little inconveniences that pile up and pile up and pile up until somebody makes a mistake. Right? You know, you finally get into a position where, you know, you've got everything together to make that one run where you're going to get in the car, drive to the store, you know the store is open, they know you have, you know, six crates of Pampers left and your name is on two of them, and you go down there to get the nappies, and then on the way back your car runs out of gas. And now you have a real problem because, you know, you're going to have to interact with a whole bunch of people to get home, and any one of those people may be infected. Do you see how this kind of works? You kind of get this, right, deals gone bad, cascade failure type stuff.
Yeah, it makes so a lot of sense.
This is sort of how these things go, is everybody's in the same boat, everybody's in trouble. But if everything goes exactly according to plan, you don't have a problem, right? We went to Walmart, we bought enough food for 3 months, I arranged that I was going to work from home, you know, we got plenty of back cash in the bank to pay the mortgage. You know, the power company people kept their game together. You know, the water company people kept their game together. Everything worked out fine. And we just kind of waited it out with everybody stayed home and, you know, grandma didn't get sick and it was all great. Right. And some percentage of people will have those experiences. On the other hand, if you're, you know, an inner city single mother with very little money who's relying on the school system to take care of your kid in the daytime while you work and that's what's paying your rent, you know, and then the school system closes, or, you know, your workplace closes, you've got a whole bunch of new problems. You don't have the capital to just go out and buy a bunch of food and then go home and wait it out. So you're in a position where you're working and then you're shopping and then you're working and then you're shopping. You're way more likely to get sick than, you know, some suburban family that basically just parks their car across their driveway and then stays inside. And so you get correspondingly more risk, correspondingly more exposure. But the thing is, the infections don't stay neatly confined, you know, because they're, this stuff is so is it by the time they go around their business, they become they're still at school and the stuff is kind of cycling forward to business as usual. In that business as usual environment, it's inevitable that infection will spread. So you have to kind of get away from business as usual, because every case of the flu, or well, I call it the flu, it's not flu, every case of coronavirus that somebody doesn't get is one more hospital bed that's available for somebody that needs it. Right? And this is the whole game at this point, is we're trying to reduce the load on the hospital system to the point where everybody that needs an emergency intervention gets one, because at that point we will lose the absolute minimum number of people that we could. If we're in a position where we do a very bad job of infection control and a lot of people get sick really, really quickly, then the hospitals will overwhelm and you'll wind up with the same kind of crisis that they have in Italy right now.
Yeah, and I like how you outlined what the simple critical infrastructure maps are. And I know that people can find this on your website that you mentioned before, the resiliencemaps.org, correct?
Yeah. And let me run through that a little more. So,
okay.
You know, so the individual level, too hot, too cold, hunger, thirst, illness, injury. Then you say, what does it take to coordinate a group? So groups, you need communications, you need transport, you need workspace, and you need some social limit on the group so that you don't have a bunch of people kind of wandering around and taking your resources and doing other stuff with them. Right? Individuals, groups, organizations. An organization is a group that has a shared map of reality. It has a shared plan relative to that shared map. And it's got a shared model for changing leadership in the event that your leadership becomes ill or otherwise unsuitable. So that sort of context is really, really important, right? You have to think of this in terms of you have to think of this in terms of what does it take for groups of people to organize into effective machinery to help other people or even to take care of their own needs, right?
I see.
There has to be some way of saying, okay, we've all agreed about what the problem is. We all understand how we're going to work together on this. And that ability to pull the pieces of that story together is really, really important. Because if you've got a group of people that are trying to help, but they haven't figured out a shared map and a shared plan and some kind of planning for how do you change leadership if something goes wrong, then they'll be ineffective when the situation actually begins to unfold. Constant miscommunication, constant problems, right? Difficult. So you have to get those things in place before you get everything straightened out, right? And once you have that story straightened out, you could become an effective organization, even if you just start with a bunch of volunteers, step by step. And then above effective organizations, this is the level of the nation state, list of citizens, map of territory, effective organizations, legal jurisdiction, and then international recognition. So that stuff is unlikely to come up in this instance because the coronavirus is not likely to topple governments in most places. But if you have situations like civil wars, it's pretty important to have a model of how the nation state level kind of interacts with the rest of these systems. Because often just getting, you know, sovereignty recognized and international trade going again is a big part of how we stabilize countries that have problems, and it's important to have a model for doing that. So this is a very flexible, you know, multi-tiered approach to defining what needs to get done in problems in a way that's actionable by people that are not professionals in handling these kind of crises, but are field professionals in whatever areas they're working in, and suddenly they're thrown into this mess and they have to work together to make it all work.
Makes sense.
And that's going to be a lot of people in the upcoming shenanigans, right?
Right. And I think it was you that I, wasn't it you that tweeted something about you were already talking with your building about how to take precautions against, you know, the spread of the coronavirus. And I think that was a good example of implementing this system, correct?
Absolutely, because the building is my neighborhood. And, you know, I got to interact with the people in my neighborhood to try and do infection control at the neighborhood level. Because if my neighbors aren't sick, I'm less likely to get sick.
Makes sense.
And let me tell you, that has not gone well because it's like, well, you know, some of the neighbors are like, well, somebody's just going to steal the hand sanitizer. It's like, well, yeah, that's a thing that could happen. Somebody else is like, but, you know, there are four contact points, right? There's, you know, you got to open the doors, then you got the lift door, then you got your own front door. There are a bunch more contact points where, hey, maybe there's places you could catch the flu. Why would we put hand sanitizer downstairs? Because if one person doesn't use it, they're going to contaminate the lift, right? And oh, that's wow. An excellent point, right? It's an excellent point. There were pictures from China. People had put pieces of polystyrene up beside the lift buttons, and then they'd covered the pieces of polystyrene in toothpicks. And the idea was that when you needed to operate the lift, you pulled off one of the toothpicks and you poked the lift with the toothpick, and that was how you went up and down in the lift.
Oh, that was how you pushed
the lift buttons. Really clever, right? Really that clever. But also think about how bad things must have been in China that these kind of things became common.
That's a good point.
Right? You see pictures of, you know, Wuhan in the middle of this thing. Everybody is going around in improvised moon suits, right? Plastic sheet, duct tape. You know, they've got 5-liter bottles like you would get for, what, water? 10-liter bottles. They've sawed the bottom off these things and they're wearing them as improvised helmets, right? And when I saw that, like, okay, so an ordinary civilian population was under sufficient stress and sufficient threat that they figured out how to make really fairly industrial personal protective equipment from whatever it was they happened to have lying around. Like, oh boy, we have a problem.
Yeah, that's what is so scary to me too, because as you're mentioning even some potential issues in your own building. I mean, it actually inspired me to talk to my own apartment building about it. I haven't done it yet, but I'm coming up with a little worksheet for it. Because, you know, people are more, I don't want to say independent, but that's the only word I can think of right now. And it seems like it's going to be difficult for that to happen here.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, but on the other hand, Americans are tough, right? You know, they're used to working together, you know, to handle crisis, everything from barn raisings through to, you know, invasions. They're pretty good once they take the problem seriously at working together to solve the problem. You know, there is a phase where everybody is a bit like, you know, ruthless independence, but right under the surface, there is a very strong communitarian streak in American culture.
Well, I appreciate saying that. It gives, I think, people hope and optimism too, which I appreciate.
Well, I mean, you know, wagons were wagon trains for a reason, right? You know, nobody went out in a wagon on their own because you were just going to get eaten alive. That was not going to work. You had to go with a group because that was how you got the stability to get the job done. And, I mean, the thing is, a lot of people will run around in crisis and say, oh, well, community is the answer, community is the answer. Community is not the answer. Community is the next horizon, right? Mm-hmm. You work on your own stuff, you get your game together, you deal with your own problems. Then you help your neighbors not cause you problems by getting sick and then getting you sick, right? Anybody that's got a problem in your neighborhood, right, that problem is kind of your problem, right? If the little old lady down the bottom of the street is running out of food, you know, if that problem gets solved in a messy, chaotic, difficult way, it increases the chance that somebody is going to get contaminated or infected in the process, most of all her, but possibly you. Right?
Yeah, right.
The whole approach to this thing is that problems get handled without anybody making hurried decisions, without anybody getting scared, without anybody panicking. You want a really calm, methodical, reasoned deal. Right? Okay, we got to go and get this lady some food. Who has food that we could go and take this lady? Okay, who's got the least possibility of already being contaminated? Okay, you haven't been outside in 4 weeks. You're not ill. We're going to give you the job of taking the food over there because you're the least likely person to be sick right now. Right? And that sort of approach is like a completely different thing than what happens when somebody gets a call and it's like, hey, you know, Mrs. McGillicuddy hasn't eaten in 3 days and she's really, really weak and somebody has to go over there and bring her food right now. Oh my God, it's an emergency. People get emotionally upset. They get kind of complicated. They begin to get kind of angry with each other because they feel afraid. And pretty soon you're dealing with something that looks like an episode of Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that sort of episode of Lost psychology, where the situation is difficult and people make a bunch of crappy decisions because they're tired, they're upset, they're overworked, they're afraid, you know, that begins the kind of cascade failure that results in a whole bunch of people getting contaminated because things weren't thought about properly and they just ran out there and started working on shit and then everything went wrong. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and I appreciate your balanced approach to this. I know I started off a bit panicky myself, but I do feel more optimism and more hope for a potential situation that could arise with this coronavirus. In conclusion, I just wanted to follow up with two brief questions. Considering that we may potentially have a quote unquote lockdown where people have to stay in their homes, like in Italy and the US. What are some, and this is maybe kind of generic, but what are some books that people could read in their maybe not spare time if we're helping other individuals, but what are some books that you would recommend people read during this time or in general?
So I would say any decent history of the 1918 flu pandemic would be really good. I can't tell you which one to read offhand, but there are a number of them. Because, you know, you have to understand that, like, we've been through this before, and although we've got tons of new technology, at the end of the day, the virus hasn't changed and human biology hasn't changed. So at that point, right, the virus is the same. It's not the same virus, but it's the same class of viruses, right? It's an infectious agent that spreads in a way which is, broadly speaking, pretty similar to flu. It's a little more easy to spread than some flus, a little less easy to spread than others. But it's, you know, it's a serious thing. And we've been through something much like this 100 years ago. And it killed a heck of a lot of people. But in the areas where they got this kind of social distancing stuff right, and people stayed away from each other, they closed the theaters early, they really managed it well, the mortality rate was half of the mortality rate in other areas. Right? It was literally half as dangerous to live in parts of the country where they got this stuff right as in parts of the country where they got this stuff wrong.
Yeah, and I think you provided I think it was you that provided an example of Philadelphia and then St. Louis, I believe, where Philadelphia had a different, like more ineffective response.
Right, and the areas where they got it right, you know, the difference was really life or death for huge numbers of people. So, you know, as we kind of go into this thing, you know, it has to be remembered that, you know, everybody's at risk and everybody makes mistakes. Right.
Good point.
And what you need to be in is a position where most of the people haven't made a mistake yet. So when somebody does make a mistake, you get exposed to somebody, but that person is not carrying the flu. They don't have coronavirus. So I keep calling it a flu, bad habit. But, you know, if you get exposed to somebody and they don't have coronavirus, your mistake has no consequence. Right. Whereas if you get exposed to somebody and they do have coronavirus, now you have a problem. Right. So the more of us are calm and methodical and do the social distancing stuff properly and stay the heck away from people and, you know, learn how to wash your hands and this whole 20-second thing where you have to scratch the back of your hands and then you rub your fingertips and, you know, all these little things you do. Right. The more of that stuff people get right, the less consequence there is when you screw something up. Right. You know, you finally get into your car, you sit down. And, you know, the next thing you realize is you're rubbing your chin and you haven't done hand sanitizer since you entered your car. Like, oh, crap, right? Mm. And at that point, you know, you've made a mistake like everybody makes, and you're either lucky and your hands aren't contaminated or now you're infected, right?
Right.
The more of us don't make the mistakes, the less you get this kind of community-acquired infection where just the virus is on everything. Right, you want to stay completely out of that situation because otherwise you really do wind up with problems. So, you know, if everybody takes care of their patch, the total impact of that is the absolute minimization of the number of people that will get sick and the absolute minimization of the peak load on the medical system, which means that when everybody is sick, they can get a bed rather than running out of beds and now you have real problems.
Right. Well, and if you don't have any other books to recommend, the last question that I have for you, and thanks again so much for taking the time out, is do you have any parting thoughts? It could be in general with anything or specific to the pandemic.
So actually, the thing that people ought to read is not a book. They ought to read Lucas's report, right? So if you go to resiliencemaps.org, there are two documents there. One is the sort of skim master document, which is called Dealing in Security. And Dealing in Security is a really detailed breakdown and a flexible model for people to think about crisis together in a way that helps people adapt and manage. And it's really good work. It's about 10 years old. It's been used by a number of governments. It's a pretty standard thing. Then there is the Macronesian Island work done by Lucas. So Lucas has a 60-page document which details every layer of response from the individual right up to the state for dealing with viral infections that go pandemic. And that uses the SCIM model. It also uses the OODA model, Observe, Orient, Decide, Act, which was from an American Air Force pilot called John Boyd. And that's a very standard model in the US military. So this whole thing is about OODA loops, right? Observe the situation, figure out what your risk is, decide what actions you will or won't take to do something about the risk, and then do those actions, then go around again and do it again.
Right.
And we're just tracking around the OODA loop, figuring out what our problems are and avoiding, you know, the consequences. So the SCIM OODA model is you use, like, you know, observe, orient, decide, act. The SCIM model is for orientation. You draw the critical infrastructure map, you figure out your needs, you figure out your exposure, you figure out who your partners are, and then when you get new information from observations, you slot it into that model, which is how you get oriented to the crisis. Then you make decisions, then you carry out actions. The SCIM model is a tool for orientation in disaster.
Makes sense. Thank you. Thank you so much, Vinay. If you don't have any parting thoughts, I would like to thank you again for your time and appreciate your balanced approach to this. I think that it's going to be a wise approach when something disastrous like this is potentially going to happen here.
Well, I mean, it really is just applied common sense, right? You could talk to anybody from epidemiology and they're going to tell you much the same thing. There will be a bunch of specific details, you know, what kind of hand sanitizer works, what kind of hand sanitizer doesn't work. There'll be people that have specific needs like insulin-dependent diabetics where you've got a whole other set of risks. You know, there's a lot of variation on these themes. But the basic principle of this is a virus and you don't want to catch it, these are the ways that it spreads, now don't do those things. You know, this is not rocket surgery. We can cope with this. What was the question you asked me right at the end when I went back and talked about Lucas's pandemic planning document?
Oh, I was just saying if you had any parting thoughts in general.
One of the things that... Okay, let's take another couple of minutes to really crack open another part of this.
Okay.
So one of the problems that we have here is what I will broadly term Christian eschatology. So eschatology is kind of the study of the end of the world. And whenever something bad happens in Christian countries, and I think this is probably true for Muslim countries as well, the lens that everybody sees this through is apocalypse. So everybody is like, oh, you know, business as usual is going to be horribly disrupted in a bad way. And immediately something inside of people's brains goes to apocalypse. And, you know, pretty soon you're thinking about The Walking Dead and Mad Max and...
Yeah.
All the rest of this imagery, because, you know, one of the core myths in Christian culture is that, you know, the world will end in a really horrible way, and it'll be years and years and years of chaos and disease and war and bloodshed and this whole tribulation model. So it's really important that we don't confuse an unusually severe outbreak of something which is not that different from a flu or a common cold, but it's the kind that kills you. Right. And we should also talk about age very briefly. That's the other two oral details that are important. So, you know, not falling into the idea that this is the apocalypse is really important. Right. It's not the apocalypse. If we did nothing at all. Right. If we took no preparations, we did no planning, everybody continued business as usual and the virus ran rampant, we'd probably lose at the end of the day about 5% of our total population, maybe 10. Right. And that is, unfortunately, completely survivable, right? Civilization will not collapse if one person in 20 dies and it's mostly old people, right? One person in 10 dies, it's mostly old people. You're really going to feel that. It's going to be remembered for centuries. But at the end of the day, this is not a civilization collapsing event, right? You'd have to mishandle this in a truly spectacular way to make this civilization threatening. So we shouldn't be freaked out in this kind of like, oh, it's the apocalypse sense. I mentioned the age of the people, right? Right now, it looks like people who are under 60 have very, very, very low mortality from this thing, right? Maybe the threshold is under 50. Certainly for people who are under 40, it just doesn't really kill you. And that's not an excuse to run around and not take precautions, because if you catch it, then you give it to somebody else and they give it to grandma, you have an issue. But this is predominantly a disease that affects the old. And I am, you know, just about 50, not in great health. I'm really burned out after, you know, multiple years running a startup. I have some pre-existing lung issues from a super bad lung infection that I got 20 years ago. So I'm in that demographic of, like, I really don't want to catch this thing.
Right.
But at the same time, if I did catch it, I'm not actually all that likely to die, because my underlying physical condition is pretty good. And, you know, I kind of, you know, it'll be fine, right? So, or I'll die. Could go either way. But it's not like I would expect to be 50% likely to die if I got it. It's probably less than 10%, because I'm well out of the age group that really has problems.
Yeah.
So it's really important to think about this in terms of, you know, what we're doing here is we're protecting ourselves and we're protecting the old. We are trying to make sure that all the old people don't catch this thing at the same time, and then we've got gigantic problems. We're also trying to make sure that the young people don't catch it, because they may require respirators. If we're out of respirators, a whole bunch of people die unnecessarily. But it's, you know, how do I say this? It's very fortunate that it's not like the 1918 flu, because the 1918 flu preferentially killed people in their 20s and their 30s.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So we're sort of in a position where, you know, however apocalyptic people might feel this thing is at times, particularly if you work in a hospital, wow, are you going to have a bad year, right? But however apocalyptic it seems at times, let us remember that we've seen worse 100 years ago, and, you know, we're going to get through this, because even the worst case is completely survivable.
Right.
Even the worst case, completely survivable.
One last thing is that, have you seen this? I've seen some information coming out that there hasn't been a lot of reported cases in higher temperature, higher humidity areas, such as like Southeast Asia. Do you have any like insight into this, or any thoughts on that? Last thoughts?
So my gut feeling is probably the critical place to check is Australia. Because Australia has a really good public health system. You know, they are, you know, as hot and dry as it's going to get this time of year, right?
Right.
So, I mean, maybe Australia isn't the place. You know, it's not like I've got a globe in front of me and I'm checking their climate data. Maybe it's South Africa. You know, maybe it's, I don't know, Honduras. But wherever it is, like, finding a place with a decent public health system and seeing what the spread looks like there is probably pretty important. I would be fairly surprised if it made that much of a difference, right?
Okay.
And let me tell you why, right? This thing appears to, generally speaking, not be airborne. So it's not something that people are catching because individual viral particles are flying around in there and they're breathing them in. It's generally speaking contained inside of the kind of droplets of water that people cough, right? So when the conditions are humid, those droplets tend to get heavier because they absorb moisture from the air and fall to the ground. But that works the same way in either cold countries or warm countries. Seasonal flus tend to hit hot countries just the same as cold countries, generally speaking, because of the contagion passing on surfaces.
I see. Okay.
So the surface contact stuff is the majority of where this stuff gets transmitted. And if the surface contact stuff is happening, there's your problem. Now, the flip side of that is the other possibility is that what's causing these differences in transmission is ultraviolet light.
Right.
So it may not be the temperature and the humidity, although those are definitely factors. It may also be that UV light is killing the stuff on surfaces, even inside of buildings.
Yeah, and I saw there was some Danish company that had these like UVC robots or something that China was implementing. I might be wrong on this, but they seem to be effective against it. Yeah, you make a good point about that. Thank you.
And, you know, there's one of the things that I'd like to come out of this thing is that we start doing really serious research on all of this stuff. So the next time we have a virus to deal with, hopefully not too soon, we actually know way more about it and we can deal with it on these levels. Because right now we just don't have the data for most of this.
Right.
We just don't know.
Right.
So the final thing I want to talk about briefly is like mental attitude to all of this, right? So the mental attitude to all of this really has to be pragmatism, right? It's not panic. It's methodical, considered response, right? It's done from a clear, rational mental model about what the risks are. And whenever you hit a position where you don't know what to do, you try and do research. If you've got the time to sit down at the internet, consult some reputable sources, figure out what the CDC says, maybe ask a doctor. You know, if you could do those kinds of things every time you have to make a serious decision, what we stay away from is kind of community-acquired nonsense. Mm. Right? We don't want to be in a position where 25 million people decide that they're going to, you know, treat with some kind of alternate remedy that doesn't work, right? Have you heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
No, never heard of that.
So two psychologists, Dunning and Kruger, they hear a case of a bank robber who robs a bank in broad daylight in front of all the security cameras without a mask. And they're like, why does this guy do this? So they investigate. Turns out that he did this because he'd covered his face with lemon juice. And they're like, could you explain this to us? And they're like, look, lemon juice is invisible ink. So I covered myself with lemon juice, so I was invisible.
Oh, boy.
Right? And their comment was, look, you know, this guy was not only too dumb to be a bank robber, he was too dumb to know he was too dumb to be a bank robber. Right? And, you know, panicked people get stupid. Right? If you go all the way back through the medieval plagues and stuff, you got crazy ideas like, you know, everybody's going to go outside and dance around in circles and that's going to scare away the spirits that are causing the plague or, you know, whatever. I'm making up that example.
Yeah.
But, you know, we want to stay really close to the science on this stuff. And that means asking experts for their opinions and reasoning from first principles about what you know about viruses. If you don't know much about viruses, go do some reading. You know, why does the virus live longer in mucus? How does hand sanitizer work? There are people publishing guides on all of this stuff all the time. A lot of that material is pretty reputable. It's science-based. It's easy to get your head around. If we stick to that kind of material and act in calm, methodical, decisive ways based on a rational understanding of the risks, we will lose the minimum number of people that we could have. If we get into a position where we've got a whole bunch of cargo cult nonsense coming in and people are doing things that don't work and then acting as if they did, we're going to have a whole bunch of new problems, right? So if it goes around that, you know, horse antibiotics are exactly what it is you take to get over this thing, and you wind up with a whole bunch of people that are trying to treat themselves with remedies that don't work, or you wind up with people who've heard that you can make hand sanitizer out of oatmeal, you know, you're really going to have problems, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, sticking close to the science gives us the best possible odds of taking effective action. And all that this boils down to in the end is we each individually and collectively and at the state level and at the national level and at the global level each take effective, disciplined action. And the sum total of all those actions across all of those levels of governance will result in the best outcome that we could have had. And that's all we can do. We try as hard as possible to make calm, rational decisions and to actually implement and to make the hard choices when we have to. And we just work our way through and make the calls.
Thank you, Vinay. Thank you for your optimism. I think you're conveying optimism and also your balanced, pragmatic approach to this. I appreciate it. Just one last thing. Where can people find you on the internet if they're not familiar with your work already?
My pandemic work is at resiliencemaps.org. And my company is called Materium, materium.com. And we're going to be organizing a bunch of pandemic flu resources. Coronavirus resources at materium.com/CSR. So we're going to do a bit of this whole corporate social responsibility stuff because two of the members of my team, myself and Anton Shalapanov, who's our MD, have really substantial infectious disease management expertise. And we're going to try and, you know, make some of that work available as we go while we continue to run the company through this whole coronavirus crisis.
Great. Vinay is an impressive guy. If you haven't already been familiar with his work, I encourage you to check out more of his work. Thank you once again, Vinay. I appreciate it, and have a great rest of your day.
Very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to do this, and I hope your listeners find it, helpful.
Thank you.